to come and listen to oral argument with us and then attend a session with a justice after our second oral argument and thus be further educated on the judicial branch of government. And the students are given information about the case and may engage in activities relating to the case. A justice is assigned to meet with the students after this second case to discuss the procedures of the court taking and hearing and deciding cases, not the substantive issues of the case. And today, I have been assigned to be the justice, but I have to appear on behalf of the court at 1 o'clock. And so I will not be the justice. And indeed, I apologize in advance if I have to leave the case. You haven't done anything to offend me. And I will listen to the remaining part of the argument before the court meets after the third case today so that I can intelligently vote. So let me introduce the court to you all. While I do that, does anyone need a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you do, you have just raise your hand. Okay. On my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and she has agreed to forfeit some of her lunch hour to meet with the students who can stay. Pardon me?
But I was...
Oh, all I can say is who's on first, what's on second,
and I don't know who's on third.
Well,
I take it all back. It must be tomorrow that I can't meet. It's Justice Prosser that you will meet, and he sits to the right of Justice Bradley. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, and I didn't read this sheet, the Chief Justice. But it goes that I will be leaving for a 1 o'clock appearance. And on my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on his left is Justice Patience Rokensack, and on the far left is a seat where ordinarily Justice Michael Gableman sits, and he is not here. He said he was going to listen to the oral argument, but his participation in the case will be determined by Justice Gableman at a later time. So here we are, and I will call the case. It is 11 AP 2916 CR, State versus Andrew M. Edler. No, Richard, that's one of my problems today. Today is 10 AP 2363. 10 AP 2364 CR State versus Richard Levon Deadwiller. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Deadwiller is Attorney Mark S. Rosen. Mr. Rosen.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, and esteemed spectators. We are clearly here, it's based upon what happened with the Supreme Court case of U.S. versus Williams. I'm sure the court is very familiar with that. That was a plurality decision. Nevertheless, it came out. It was the decision of the court in which Justice Alito rendered the decision. And what is most important about that, well, there's two issues that are most important about that. The first thing that I think is clearly most important about that is Justice Alito clearly indicated in that case that his ruling, the ruling of the Supreme Court in that case, allowing the non-truth of the matter asserted material concerning the, I think it was Orchard Cellmark in that case too, from Texas, was only to be used in a bench trial unless there were cautionary jury instructions and the court had seriously considered the issue of juror confusion. That was that case, and that came out in that case, and that case is fine for bench trials. Williams was a bench trial. Unfortunately, this case with Mr. Deadwiller was a jury trial, and we have that issue here with a jury trial. Another problem that is distinguishing between that case is, to boot, not only was that case, the issue became non-testimonial because the state never introduced in that case, Illinois never asked to introduce in that case, the material for the truth of the matter asserted. They just wanted it as background. In this case, Mr. Detweiler's case, the state made a motion before trial. They litigated it. They argued it. They wanted that material in substantively. They wanted it in substantively. And what they did is they got it in substantively. Mr. Witticki, the DNA crime lab expert, got on the stand, and the state asked him, once Orchard Selmark's information came out from both of the victims, and you put in the DNA database, what was the result? Who did it point to? And Mr. Witticki, and this is not what happened in Williams. Williams, there was nothing like this. They just said, well, what happened next? Mr. Witticki said it was Mr. Detweiler who did it, which is clearly substantive use of this information, and it was inadmissible. And basically, maybe not, comes in for the truth of the matter asserted. Clearly, a bench trial, the judge would have been able to resolve that and been able to decide that and been able to figure this out, which is what Justice Alito said, and Justice Alito said in his plurality decision. But unfortunately, here we have the issue where this material comes in. And one thing about Mr. Witticki is the state has made a good deal of points about how he kind of reviewed some of the bar graphs and stuff like that. But the case law, Williams and Town, which is the state cases, which the U.S. Supreme Court case, Williams, comes out and basically kind of takes over this situation now, basically talks about Witticki never went to, had any involvement with the DNA work in Texas, never went there, never had an opportunity to do peer review, never had any opportunity to do, look at how their materials were, how they did their testing, how they did their research, how they did everything out there in Orchard. Williams and Barton were the two cases the state relied on in the state court case. Both of those are basically people from the crime lab.
Mr. Rosen, do you think that it's significant here that you have a situation where there really is no identity issue in regard to the DNA, that your client basically is saying this is a consent case, I agree that I had intercourse with these two women, it's pure and simply consent. Doesn't that make a difference?
It would make a difference. The only problem is that the colloquy that the state, that Judge McMahon did, was after the state had already rested. The state never introduced any sort of Mirandi statements from my client where he said that. Basically, the state said, we're going to introduce the DNA and have the two victims testify. After the state rests, the client, Mr. Detweiler, gets up and says, you know, there's some issues I want to talk about. So basically, that whole becomes an issue only after the state had rested. So basically, until then, the defendant had been contesting identity. They vociferously argued at the beginning of the pretrial motions that this shouldn't come in. Mr. Lipscomb, his trial attorney, argued against this material coming in, argued, didn't say, you know, get it in, it's going to be a consent case. They argued to keep it out. And Mr. Lipscomb, Mr. Detweiler's trial attorney, vociferously argued, cross-examined Witticki. He basically asked him questions about what happened, how it went on. I'm sorry. And that kind of becomes, so the only reason it became a consent case is once the state had rested. And I think we have to kind of put the cart before the horse in terms of what happened to get to that point. And I think it's always the issue is, would he have even testified if this had been out? We don't know. I'm sorry.
Is it your position that Williams has no bearing at all on this case?
Is that the U.S. Supreme Court case, Williams? No, my position is that U.S. versus Williams is basically the law now. And U.S. versus Williams basically states, and I think the state argued that, too, because the state they wanted adjournments at the Court of Appeals level, from my recollection, because Williams was coming out. We basically briefed and we had a rebrief. Basically, Williams is our position is that Williams is applicable, and Williams says this sort of material is okay to come in at a bench trial.
Okay, it says, so are you saying that Alito was, his ruling was that in a bench trial, this is not testimonial, but in a jury trial, it is testimonial?
No, in a bench trial, I think his position was the way the state handled this. This is not presented for the truth of the matter asserted anyway. Although in Deadwell's case, the state did get it in as for the truth of matter asserted, but it's not presented for the truth of matter asserted, just to see what they did next. Only problem is that there's the risk of juror confusion, and you need cautionary jury instructions. And that's what Justice Alito stated, is clearly he stated, that they could not, that this material could not, and he said, didn't say may not, he didn't say should not, he didn't say any sort of caveats like that. His exact words were, absent the dissent, petitioner elected to have a jury trial. In that event, there would have been a danger of the jurors taking Lambados, who was the Williams, the Illinois ex-crime lab person, testimony as proof that the cell mark profile was derived from the sample obtained from the victim's vaginal swabs. Absent an evaluation of the risk of juror confusion and careful jury instructions, the testimony could not have gone to the jury. This case, however, involves a bench trial, and we must assume that the trial judge understood that the portion of Lombardo's testimony, which the dissent objects, was not admissible to prove the truth of the matter asserted. So that's what we are saying, and that's what Justice Alito said, is that you need to have this sort of risk of juror confusion, this risk of the evaluations.
Do you think that Williams stands for the proposition on the narrowest grounds that at least a majority of the court decided this kind of evidence is not testimonial?
Under the circumstances in this case, yes. I think, yes, they basically said it's not testimonial because it was simply to show what happened next. The only problem was in this sort of non-testimonial evidence then comes out substantively in our case where basically the state goes about and says, well, you know, Mr. Witticki, what were the results? What happened? What evidence? Mr. Deadwiler was the DNA match.
I guess I do hear you saying that Williams really isn't applicable in this case for two reasons. One, it wasn't used for the truth of the matter asserted in the U.S. Supreme Court case. And two, it was a bench trial, not a jury trial.
Well, I'm saying that it is applicable in the sense that it says that in this sort of a situation in jury trials in Wisconsin, you have to have cautionary jury instructions and a risk of juror an evaluation of that. And I'm saying is that Williams, the U.S. Supreme Court case Williams, and it gets confusing because you have the state Williams case too, but the U.S. Supreme Court case of Williams basically says that the way Judge McMahon handled this at the trial level in Mr. Deadwiler's case was improper because it came in improperly and it came in without having cautionary jury instructions. It came in basically inappropriately.
Okay, so you're asking us to adopt Alito's reasoning.
With respect to that, yes. That I think that was basically what it was. And I think that's – and we also have – I think the U.S. Supreme Court case of Williams also, I think, sort of, to a certain extent, abrogates. I mean, the state asked for its adjournments based upon the U.S. Supreme Court case of Williams, which kind of is factually very close to this. But the fact of the matter is, in Williams – here, contrary to the state Williams, court case of Williams and the state court case of Barton, there was never any peer review. There was never any review of the material. Mr. Witticki never went down there. It never met the standards of those two cases anyway, of the state case of Williams and the state case of Barton, which was required. And I think also, I think another thing that needs to be considered is that the state, in its respondent's brief, also argued about the state case of Williams, but never really argued that Justice Alito's decision was wrong in terms of having, you have to have this evaluation of juror confusion, this evaluation of these cautionary jury instructions. The state simply indicated that these are issues of evidentiary practice and jury management under state law. They are not issues of constitutional magnitude implicating the Confrontation Clause. But it's clearly, I think, this Court has got the duty to evaluate that and to make that decision. Furthermore, I don't think Justice Alito limited his ruling to state law. He's limited it to basically, as the U.S. Supreme Court talking about how this comes in sort of any case. And I also indicate, I don't think it really even responds to my argument that there's this issue of juror confusion and juror, if you need these cautionary instructions.
What kind of cautionary instruction would you have suggested?
That's a very good question. I was thinking that basically it would be something to the nature specifically designed to this, that you have heard Mr. Waticky testify as to the DNA crime lab results from Orchard Cellmark. You are not to take that as the truth of the matter asserted. You are to only to consider that for what might have happened next. I think that is kind of something in that nature and something in that realm. I'm sure the jury commission can evaluate that better. Maybe some sort of a modified other acts type of something of that nature. But here, clearly, we have the issue of the juror confusion here, because I think the state might have been able to get around it by simply not asking that question. What did the Orchard Cellmark material result in? Because it resulted in the DNA database matching Mr. Deadwell. I mean, they did further testing later on based upon that, and they took the swab. So that was the bottom line. But the state in the trial wanted that substantive evidence. They wanted to get in Orchard Cellmark's substantive results. And
now, why did they want the substantive result in if the defense was consent?
Because I think they wanted to get in just to bolster their victims, because they weren't planning to put on any Mirandi statements that my client might have given to them. I don't know why. They may have felt that there was an issue of constitute Fifth Amendment application with the statements. I don't know what was going on, but they wanted to get that in to bolster their victims, because the victims, they had credibility problems. They had alcohol use. One of the victims was borderline mentally retarded. They had criminal records. They had, one of them had a cocaine history, and one of them had been at a party and been drinking and using drugs. One of the victims didn't even look at a photo array and didn't even identify my client. It was at night. It was late. So they needed the DNA results, and maybe they felt there was a problem with the Miranda Goodchild motion, with the Miranda's statements that my client gave. I'm kind of operating in a vacuum, because it was a different attorney who handled this at the trial level. But that was what the state, from my recollection, was what the state indicated at the final pretrial, was they were going to use the DNA and the victims and not get in any statements of my client. And then the issue becomes, basically, can you prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? My client, after the state had arrested, says, I've heard some things I've got concerns about. I want to testify. And so I think saying that this was a consent case before the state had arrested, I think, is kind of putting the cart before the horse, but that's kind of where it is. I don't think it became a consent case until after the state had arrested, based upon what we have here. It's like I indicated, Mr. Lipscomb, the trial attorney, vociferously argued to keep the DNA out, or to sell Mark's information out, and he cross-examined Mr. Waticky very vigorously.
Was there any attempt to show that Cellmark had troubles on DNA testing?
I don't recall that. I think it just basically boiled down to an issue of the confrontational clause type of a thing. I don't remember that as being an issue. I think that basically came out that, we want to cross-examine Orchard Cellmark. They're not here. Waticky, contrary to William, the state Williams and Barton, has never been down there. He doesn't know what they do. He doesn't know how they do it.
Well, what kind of decision do you want? You want a decision that every time you have two different labs involved in DNA testing, that you got to have a witness from each of the labs?
Well, I'm saying that if this is going to be presented for not for the truth of the matter asserted, then it needs to be dealt with in a manner that satisfies Justice Alito's decision, that you have to have a discussion about juror confusion and you have to have cautionary jury instructions. And that's kind of what didn't happen here. I appreciate the court's coming from, but I'm kind of looking at Mr. Deadwell's case.
Well, I don't understand how you can say it's not presented for the truth. The Cellmark lab did a DNA portrait, in effect, right?
Correct.
Did a picture of the DNA. So they are presenting that the evidence that they were given, right?
The DNA lab or Orchard Cellmark?
semen that they were presented.
Yes.
Or whatever was taken from the victim was presented, that this is a truthful portrayal of the DNA in that sample. Isn't that what Cellmark is saying?
Correct. And that's when it becomes an issue of confrontational clause.
And then this crime lab gets that DNA portrayal, and it matches it up against this defendant.
Correct. But what they did was they used the DNA Orchard Cellmark's material. And that was the whole purpose of the beginning. They used the Orchard Cellmark material, and the DNA person came there and says, Orchard Cellmark, once you commit it, says it's Mr. Deadweiler sitting right over there. And I think that Alito's decision basically almost says that that's not admissible. If you don't bring it in, the truth of the matter is certain. If, bottom line, I think, is that if the state hadn't sought that out, hadn't said, you know, who does it match up to, I think we might not even be here. I think it might have been a different issue. But I think Alito basically says you can't do that the way the Illinois courts did it by not presenting it that way. Becomes a non-truth of the matter asserted issue, and even then you have a non-truth of the matter asserted issue where they don't bring out who did it, because that didn't, in the U.S. Williams, the Illinois people never said who did it. They just simply said, what'd you do next?
Well, Cellmark never said who did it.
Witticki testified, and he took the Orchard Cellmark's results,
right,
matched them up to the DNA database, mm-hmm, without having done any work, the crime having done any work, and it came up to Deadweiler.
Her client.
And he said that. He said, Mr. Deadweiler. It pointed out to Mr. Deadweiler. Right. And then it becomes substantive. I think the U.S. Williams case almost says you can't do that because it sort of violates. And then even if it is, even if the state hadn't mentioned that statement, hadn't said, you know, it matches up to Mr. Deadweiler, even then you still need to have the issue of the risk of juror confusion and the cautionary jury instruction. Because this was a bench trial. So I think the U.S. Williams case is almost a double stoppage of what happened at the trial court level. And I think that's why it's there. And I think it comes out. I mean, I know it does state that this is okay the way it handled, but it almost helps Mr. Deadweiler here. And yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask this. Orchard Cellmark. There are two different samples. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And let's say this is sample one.
Yes.
And they test it and they send it back. But do they ever say, in this sample, we have DNA of Mr. Deadweiler?
No, they never said that. They did some prep. They did a profiling, so to speak. That came out to Mr. Deadweiler, and that happened with both of them at different times. But then Mr. Witticki then takes that profile, enters it into the DNA database, and it comes back as Mr. Deadweiler, as Mr. Deadweiler. But
okay.
He basically takes...
So on both of the reports that are sent back, there is no statement by Orchard Cellmark that this... sample contains Mr. Deadweiler's DNA.
That's correct.
So who made the judgment that, in fact, these samples contained Mr. Deadweiler's DNA?
Well, Mr. Witticki did after he introduced the Orchard Cellmark profiles.
Oh, okay.
Which he received, and he'd never been down to Texas to review it or anything like that. It just blindly took them in and introduced them at the DNA database, and that popped up Mr. Deadweiler's.
But let us say whoever was down in Texas working on these samples, there might have been two different people.
Right.
Okay. Suppose there were two different people, and you brought them both up here. What would you have asked them? Or anybody asked them.
How it happened, what happened, how you did it, what happened. See, I don't know. I just think that you need to have the right to confront that person to see what it is. Maybe you can get an expert to say the way they did it was improper. But you don't have any of that here because it just comes in blindly.
I thought he had an expert, and he decided not to have that expert go forward because he thought the expert would come up with the same conclusion, at least in part. So he decided to go to trial instead of having his expert come up here.
He did. There was an issue about Dr. Friedman, but still Dr. Friedman cannot analyze what happened down in Texas in terms of how they prepared the work.
I guess I'd see it a little differently maybe if his defense changed because of this. Oh, gosh, I'm stuck with this DNA testimony. Now my defense has to be this is consensual. But his defense, as I understood it, stayed the same all along. It was that this was consensual. Yes, I had sex with these women, but it was consensual. It was not a sexual assault.
But my recollection was until it got to the level where he actually testified at trial, that wasn't how it was presented. I mean, the state sort of, Mr. Lipscomb vociferously argued to keep this evidence out. He said, we want to have a right to test it, cross-examine. It violates the Confrontation Clause. He then cross-examined Witticky vociferously. If he was going to say this was consensual, we're not worried about the DNA, I don't think that would have been an issue, and he wouldn't have taken that position. The only time that Detweiler says, you know, I want to testify and present the consensual issue that is consensual is after the state had arrested. And he said during the colloquy, I've heard some things that worry me, and therefore I want to speak my piece.
Well, but what about the part where they're talking about him not wanting an adjournment because his expert wasn't going to be done with his results? And I think his own lawyer said, I think he'd come up with the same results anyway, and the issue here really is consent. It's not whether it's his DNA.
That's, like I indicated, I think that that only became an issue after the state had rested. I think if they had done a good job, if they kept it out, or then I don't know what
they started trial, and the judge then said, gosh, if you want an expert, we'll just adjourn the whole trial? That I'm trying to figure this out. I mean, it wasn't the judge talking about adjourning this?
There was
some
mention
about
adjourning
it. You can go to trial Monday,
it.
Or I'll adjourn it so your expert can come here. And then his lawyer said, no, my client wants to go to trial because his defense really is whether this is consensual. And his expert's probably going to come up with the same thing. I kind of, that's the way I read it, so I need you to help me out here because I'm thinking.
He did say that at the beginning, but then once the trial progressed and he argues to keep out the Orchard cell mark because it violates the Confrontation Clause, he then cross-examines Witticky about, you know, how this happened and all this sort of stuff, and all this becomes out, then I think, you know, it was a proof beyond a reasonable doubt as to whether or not they did it until all of a sudden Mr. Detweiler gets on the stand in his case and starts talking about how this is all consensual. But until that point in time, you know, we don't have a consent. We just simply have this, you know, can the state prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt? I see my lights on. I don't know.
You have five more minutes. That's a warning light, sir. You have about five more minutes.
Okay.
What are the odds that, let's say, my DNA is identical to somebody else's DNA?
Well, in this day and age, I think that probably they have so many alleles and so many markers that it almost becomes...
It might be if you have an identical twin.
Right.
I didn't hear that.
You might be if you have an identical twin that you will have it. And there may be great similarities if the DNA is of a family member. So it would lower the percent. So, you know, otherwise it might be 99.6% that this is the person. If it's a family member, it might drop down to 85 or still be a high percent. If it's an identical twin, you might have trouble showing which twin's DNA it is, if I'm right about my science.
I think what I'm trying
to... I wasn't right about you today, so I wouldn't trust me on anything more important than that. So, you know, take that into consideration.
Is there any plausible argument that the two samples were somehow confused or mixed together or anything like that down in Texas?
We don't know because nobody from Texas came up to talk. I mean, nothing came up from Texas except it went to the crime lab, some profiles, and that was it. So there's no way to evaluate it. We don't know anything about Orchard Selmark. We don't know if it's a fly-by-night. I mean, we don't know.
Didn't they have a report? Didn't Selmark have a report? They usually have some.
I think they had a report, but it was their self-generated report, and I think there were some bar grams that came up that, you know, like anybody can issue a report. I mean, it's really tough to say. One of the things I remember the State Williams and the State Barton cases talking about was how the peer review, the person that actually testified, has knowledge of how the other person or the other entity did its work. And here there was nothing of that nature. There was nothing of that nature. And then he gets up there and says, Orchard Selmark, by the way, we ran it to the database, and it's this guy over here. And there's no way to do that because there's nothing came up except maybe, you know, a two-page piece of paper and some, you know, some computer stuff or whatever. I don't know. Well, I'm out of time.
As I understand it here, now you attack what I'm about to say. But a sample that's sent down to Texas at one time, and then at another time, another sample is sent down to Texas. Okay, and this sample is tested at one time, and this sample is tested at a different time. And this sample is sent back at one time, and this sample is sent back at a different time. Now, both of these samples seem to show that there is a particular DNA that is common to both of them. They don't know whose DNA that is, and they don't say whose DNA that is. How is there a problem here?
Well, I think the problem becomes is we don't know how everything gets calculated, how they do their work. We don't know if things got mixed up, or some person may have said, you know, they got it mixed up, and somebody's DNA gets mixed up with somebody else's DNA. We don't know what Texas does down there. We don't know how they mix it. We don't know the qualifications of the testing person or persons. I don't even remember if it was one person or the same person, two people that did it. We don't know that, and I think that's part of the crux of why you have a confrontational clause violation here, and that's where we have this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin is Warren D. Weinstein. Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The key, I think, about Williams versus Illinois is if this case was before that court, there are five justices who would vote to affirm because the DNA electropherogram is non-testimonial. That does not depend on whether it's hearsay. It does not depend on whether or not it's entered for the truth of it. If it's non-testimonial, it does not violate the Confrontation Clause. It may indeed violate state hearsay law or federal hearsay law, but it does not violate the Confrontation Clause.
Counsel, if you had an expert testifying and the expert said, my opinion relies on this report from Orchard, and my opinion is that to a reasonable scientific probability or certainty, there is a match. And the expert says, hey, I'm not saying that what I'm relying on is truthful. I'm not asserting that what I'm relying on and basing my opinion on is truthful. But my opinion to a reasonable scientific certainty is there's a match. Isn't that silly?
And it's not silly, and the reason it's not silly is because so long as the expert is not repeating what's in the report, It is the witness's opinion that that person has concluded on their own, and they are subject to cross-examination.
Suppose in my hypothetical, which may or may not be the facts here, because I don't know the record well enough, suppose the expert said the report indicated that there was foreign DNA in the specimens taken by the two women. I'm not saying that's true. I'm not saying that that report is true. But, you know, so in other words, he's relying on substantive evidence or substantive information, I'll say, in the report.
That might be a problem, but that's not what happened here.
But that's not the facts here?
No.
He didn't indicate.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
What Tickey testified, he examined the electropherograms. Now, let me explain how this process works. The Texas lab gets a swab that has human fluid on it, semen in this case. They take that swab and they subject it to chemical reagents that extract the DNA from the swab. They then isolate and in this process, they amplify the DNA that's there, which is why this kind of test is so valuable, because you don't need a big sample. They take that DNA and they put it into a machine that performs what is chemically known as electrophoresis. That's why what Mr. Watiki testifies to is, he says, electrophoreticograms. I've seen in other cases, and I think generally speaking, they're called electropherograms. They put the sample DNA in one end of that machine, and out of the other end of the machine comes a printout that has what looks like bar graphs, and that is what's called the electropherogram. Watiki testified he took the electropherogram that the Texas lab developed. He checked it himself. He discovered that it was a good sample, and by that he meant that the results were above the level that nationally has been set as being significant for particular alleles in the DNA. They test for 13 different loci, they call them. They're particular identifying chemicals on the DNA chain. He took those. When he determined that they were significant, he put them into the computer, which has known electropherograms entered into it. The computer kicked out a hit, which was Mr. Deadwiller. He went to Mr. Deadwiller and got another sample from Mr. Deadwiller, which he ran himself. In other words, he took the swab, he did the extraction, he put it in the machine, he took the electropherogram. He compared that ferrogram to the ferrogram that he got from Texas, and he determined that there was a match. Texas never, ever said there was a match, either between Deadwiller and the samples or between the samples.
Does this electropherogram indicate the presence of foreign DNA in the specimen?
It does. And it also indicates when there is more than one donor. And in fact, in Chanty's case, there was more than one donor.
So, again, I don't know the record, but none of his testimony says, I corroborated then the correctness of Orchid Selmark's documentation. In other words, even though I independently corroborated, that subsumes that he's testifying that the electropherogram, which showed foreign DNA in the specimen, is part of his opinion.
Well, there was no reason to corroborate it, because he was using the original electropherogram that Texas had developed. Well, the only thing he would need to corroborate was that Texas followed the protocols that have been set nationwide in developing the electropherogram.
Let me ask this, because I don't know that much about electropherograms. But, of course, testimony isn't just words out of my mouth. You know, and evidence isn't, testimonial evidence isn't just words out of my mouth. The old phrase, a picture can tell a thousand words, right? And so what does this electropherogram tell you? Doesn't it tell you of the presence of foreign DNA you indicated? So it gives a message, doesn't it?
It doesn't. Well, your problem there is the word foreign. What it indicates is what alleles have been isolated by the process of electrophoresis.
Okay.
And so it is the same thing, for instance, if you ever did chemistry as in high school where you do a titration and the little stuff in a flask changes color. This is an electronic output that says the stuff in the flask changed color. What it does is it documents where the alleles for the sample that was put in occurred. So you can look at the electropherogram and say there's an allele at loci 12. There's an allele at loci 4.
What does that tell you?
Well, it doesn't tell you anything.
Oh, and why even look at it if it doesn't tell you anything?
Well, it doesn't tell you anything until you compare it to another electropherogram and say both of these have an allele at loci 4. Both of these have an allele at loci 12. Both of these have an allele at loci, and Witticki did that and got 13 different alleles, which is all they test for both Detweiler and for the sample.
Okay.
He did that on his own.
But Cellmark gets a fluid. That fluid not only has semen, it has bodily fluid of the woman, too.
That's correct.
And that fluid may have DNA of a third or a fourth or a fifth party if that woman had intercourse with other people within a reasonably short time of the intercourse at issue here, right?
Right.
So Cellmark, and I think this may be what Justice Bradley is driving at, Cellmark makes a decision about identifying, pulling out one person's DNA and doing its profile on it. Okay.
I don't think that's correct. Now, there probably was a report that may have done that, but the report was never testified to, was never admitted into evidence,
and the
jury never saw it.
That's right. And so the person from the state lab, I assume he looked at it to evaluate what he was getting. What didn't he?
Well, what can I ask what you mean by it?
It, the DNA profile, the electro count.
He looked at the what his testimony is I compared the electropherogram, which is the raw data, and he testified that it was the raw data. I looked at the electropherogram that Texas developed, and ultimately I compared it with an electropherogram that I developed from Detweiler, and in my opinion, there's a match.
And we don't know whether Cellmark did it properly. That's what we don't know.
The evidence that we have about that is he said, I reviewed the paperwork they were bound to do a certain protocol both by the contract they entered into with the state and by the national assertion or the national certification. I looked at the paperwork and I assured myself that they had followed the protocol. Now, to that extent, he may have been repeating something that was
right.
Right. But that is not a confrontation violation because that aspect was not, that was to explain the basis of his own opinion.
The difficulty with what you're saying, and given the questions that my colleagues just asked, is if he only testified about his report and didn't use the ORCID report in any way, would he have been able to tie Mr. Deadwiller to these two women by his DNA analysis alone?
If by report you mean what?
His testing alone, does that tie Mr. Deadwiller to these two women? Without relying on the ORCID analysis.
If you relied on nothing from the ORCID analysis,
right.
The answer to that question would be no.
Right. That's the point that they're making, I think.
The fallacy in that assertion or view is that what the ORCID developed was something that was created, was a computer-generated image. He took that computer-generated image and compared it to another computer-generated image and determined that they matched. Now, this is where all the state law that Mr. Rosen was talking about extensively comes in. That's whether or not that is an issue, is a matter of hearsay or not, depends on state law. Under Illinois state law, what the Illinois court said and what Justice Alito said was, Illinois permits, when an expert testifies, I compared these two pieces of data, and in my opinion, they are a match. Either the proponent or the opponent of that can then put in evidence of the basis for that expert's testimony. And because it's the basis of the testimony under Illinois law, that's not hearsay. Under our law, at least the current law, because the electropherogram is generated by a computer, it's simply not hearsay under any theory. That's the Ken Deutsch or Dutch case. So the electropherogram under Wisconsin law is not hearsay, period. He takes an image that's not hearsay, he compares it to another image that's not hearsay, and he says, in my opinion, this is a match. He's on the stand. You can cross-examine him on that. There's no confrontation problem. Everything else is an evidentiary issue under state law. Not only that, but that's only one of the plurality's justifications for the end result in Williams versus Illinois. What Mr. Rosen ignores is that four of the justices believe this kind of testing and this whole DNA thing is non-testimonial because there's no target at the time that the testing takes place. Justice Thomas doesn't buy that, but Justice Thomas says it's not testimonial because it doesn't have sufficient solemnity. The four also talk about solemnity, but they never tell us what exactly it is that they believe is enough. But no doubt, if you take this case, there was no target at the time that Texas did either one of those tests, so it's non-testimonial for the four in the plurality, and it has none of the solemnity that Thomas would require, so it's non-testimonial for him. If that's the case, we don't care if it's hearsay or not, whether it's admitted for the truth of it or not. That's all a matter of state law. If it's non-testimonial, whether it's hearsay or not just falls out of the case.
So you need to be a target at the time of the initial testing.
According to the plurality, they use this primary purpose. Now, the primary purpose aspect of the confrontation actually developed because of cases like Davis versus Washington and Bryant versus New Mexico. And what the court was considering there was not these out of state or out of court kinds of statements, but interrogations by police, which is a whole different area. And in that, in developing that, especially in Bryant, we get this whole thing of what's the primary purpose of the interrogation for the purpose of developing evidence at trial in a criminal prosecution. Well, the four under Alito's, that joined Alito's opinion, Alito and the three others, took that primary purpose out of the interrogation aspect of the confrontation law and imported it over into this report business. Now, the two cases prior to this, dealing with these kinds of reports, Melendez-Diaz and Bullcoming, both of them was clear from the statute in Massachusetts in Melendez-Diaz or from the way they use the statement in Bullcoming, that those reports were a substitute for testimony. In fact, Bullcoming even had chain of custody evidence in it. So
let me ask you this. Do you know how this, every time someone's convicted of a felony, they have to submit a DNA sample and there's the surcharge, right? So they just are in a bank.
Right.
Let's say his sample was already in the DNA bank, and then the swabs and the analysis were done by ORCID. Would ORCID have to come testify then about the subsequent testing and the results and how that matched the initial DNA sample in the state crime lab data bank?
I don't think they could. They didn't have anything to do with the DNA samples that resulted in what went into the database.
Now you've really lost me. Because under your theory, that initial sample is provided, it's not testimonial, it's in the state data bank, it's intended to be there to help people solve crimes and match people up later if necessary, and you're telling me that ORCID couldn't testify that their samples match that previous DNA sample given in the state data bank?
That's right. And the reason is because there are two different electropherograms. There's the electropherogram that Texas develops from the victim, and there's the electropherogram that somebody developed when Detweiler was convicted of another felony. And Texas didn't have access to that data bank. Texas didn't see Detweiler's electropherogram. Texas could not have concluded that the electropherograms developed from the victims matched anything other than the other victim.
Okay, so then
they didn't even do that.
Could a third witness come in and say, look, I've looked at both of these reports and they match up?
Yes, and that was Witticky. He did it. He took the electropherogram from Texas. He got the electropherogram, first of all, but just as an investigative lead. He got the electropherogram that was in the database, and he compared them. When he thought they matched, he went out and got another sample from Detweiler, developed a third electropherogram, which he knew from his own knowledge that it was Detweiler's, and then he compared that one to the Texas one. And he said, again, it's my opinion, they matched. That was the testimony he presented, and he presented that for both victims. So he was the one who did all of the comparison. Texas never did a comparison. Whoever did develop the electropherogram that was in the state database never did a comparison. The only person who did a comparison was Witticky. The Texas folks could have said, this is the electropherogram that we developed from the sample you sent to us. We followed the procedures. We think, here's how we did the procedures. Here's why we think the alleles on this unknown sample are sufficient under the protocol that everybody uses for significant results on the allele. And we think we have a significant profile. We don't know who it is. They couldn't say that. All they could say is, here's how we did it, here, and here's what we got. And in our view, this is a good sample. Witticky got that back. He got essentially three things back from Texas, not all at the same time either. He got a report which probably said all of this stuff about how they did the tests and on all of that stuff. He got an electropherogram, which was in fact the result of the test. And at a later time, he got all the samples back. Now, he took the electropherogram and himself compared it to a known electropherogram, that being the one in the state database and later the one that he developed himself. And his testimony was these two ferrograms match, and I therefore, it's my opinion that they come from the same, that the sample that went to Texas and the sample Detweiler gave come from the same source. That's what happened. What you could cross-examine the people from Texas about would only have to do with how they did the testing. And frankly, Justice Prosser mentioned might have been more than two people. Justice Alito says, from the same company in a different location, 10 to 20 people do it. They do hundreds of thousands of these things. If you'd have brought a witness up from Texas, my guess is the only way they could have testified about what actually happened in this case is by referring to notes. Because they wouldn't remember. They may not even be the witness who did the whole thing. But the key here is it's the electropherogram that's the important piece of evidence, because that's what you compare to a known sample to determine if they come from the same source. That's what Witticky did. He did the whole thing, and he was on the stand.
Do they check, let me just say, in reading page 90 of the transcript, it looks to me, on Witticky's testimony, when asked, you know, once you get the electropherogram and documentation, what do you do? Answer, what we're looking for is we're checking to see that they followed their procedures, that their quality control measures were followed. They got acceptable results on their control values. Then we evaluate the electropherogram, which is the end product or the typing result from the evidence, and we determine if it is of sufficient quality for entry into our local DNA database.
Okay. What he's saying there is, one, they run controls when they run the sample. There's a control, a positive control, which is they have a sample, a known sample. Texas knows the sample, what the results should be at the other end, and they run a blank. They then take, when they get the electropherogram from Detweiler, they also get an electropherogram, usually right before, from their known sample, and they compare it and say, yep, it came up the way it's supposed to. The machine is working. That's what the control tells them. The blank, if they get anything, the machine's not working. So the blank has to come up as a blank. Those are the controls. That's what he's talking about. He had those ferrograms. He looked at them. He said, looks like their machine was working. Then the quality that he's talking about is what I referred to earlier is, when they get these electropherograms, they get lines, and some of the lines are kind of small. There's a national standard about how high those lines have to be before they're considered significant. What he's saying is the results on the alleles were above that standard.
Again, I have not taken the opportunity to review the full transcript, but I note in the opinion of the Alito opinion, there is some discussion about that the analyst who testified in that case, Sandra Lombatos, did not vouch for the accuracy of Cellmark's profile. Is there anything in this transcript where Witticky vouched for the accuracy of Cellmark's profile?
Well, I'm not sure what it meant, what Justice Alito meant by that. Because if what he's talking about, which is what I believe based on the rest of his opinion, is that she didn't vouch for the fact that the electropherogram she had actually came from the victim, because as Justice Alito emphasized in his opinion, that conclusion came from the chain of custody evidence. So what I think he was saying there is that the expert said, assuming that this electropherogram came from the victim, and assuming that this electropherogram came from the defendant, because in the Illinois case, they had a second DNA expert who testified about the testing and putting it into the database. So what Lombardi said was, if I assume that this one came from the victim, and I assume that this one came from the defendant, it's a match, and I conclude that the defendant was the source of the DNA in the victim. That's what he meant, I think. But you're right, it's not particularly clear, so maybe he meant something else. I guess we'll find out in future cases. But what Witticky said in this case, he didn't say anything. There was never any question, because Didwiller never raised it, that the electropherogram was, in fact, the electropherogram from the victim's sample. So the only thing Witticky said was, I compared this victim sample to Deadwiller's sample, which I got myself, and I conclude there's a match, and therefore I conclude Deadwiller was the source of the victim's, of the DNA in the victim. But, and I want to make sure I get this before I get the red light, it is incorrect that the only reason this was a consent case was because the state presented the DNA evidence. That's absolutely not true. And it is most vividly demonstrated by Record 34 at page 11, where the assistant DA says, it's going to be, meaning the case, in my view, a credibility case. And skipping over, the defendant, no, I agree with him, the DA, 100%. And the court then says, so it's a consent or credibility case. This occurred before the trial. This was on March the 26th. Not only that, Mr. Rosen mentions the statements, and they were never introduced. And the reasons the statements were never introduced is because the only thing Deadwiller said in those statements was, I had consensual sex with these women. If he had taken some position other than that this was a consent case, you bet those statements would have come in. But they didn't come in because that's not what he did. He took the consent state position, and because he took the consent position, there was no need for the statements, because all they established was that it was that he claimed it was consent. Well, he got up on the he claimed that all throughout the trial, and he got up on the stand and he testified to that. So everything is consistent. Didn't have anything to do with the DNA.
Are there any other questions? If not, thanks, counsel.
Well,
rebuttal.
Thank you. Everything that the state has presented to you about how they compare the electropherograms to this, and he compared it, and then he gets the DNA, and he inputs it, and then he gets his own result, and that sort of thing, that's fine and dandy. The only problem was is that he gets on the stand. Witticky gets on the stand, and I just reviewed the transcripts, and he said he testified to a jury of 12 individual people that we took the DNA profiles, evaluated by the court himself, and the state asked him, did you do your own testing? This is at the April 8, 2008 in the morning. I referenced this in my rebuttal brief. Did the state crime have just retested the samples yourself, or do your Hillman's work? No, he said they would basically defeat the purpose of the grant to do the Orchard Cellmark work. Grant was designed through federal funds to help us alleviate our DNA backlog. So then he testified to a jury of 12 that both male DNA profiles at Orchard Cellmark had figured out and calculated went into the DNA database. He explained then that there's a hit. There was a hit, and he gets on the stand and testified there was a hit for Christina Stevens. And the question, this is in front of the jury, what type of a match was there in Shanti Oliver and Christina Stevens? Both of them were matching to an individual by the name of Richard Deadwine. So the matches were, he testified to the jury of 12 that this was a match to Richard Deadweiler based upon the foreign the profiles evaluated by Orchard Cellmark. Now, it's fine and dandy. I can understand that later on he went about and they used that as an investigative tool because he testified to that. That wasn't the end of it. We then used that as an investigative tool to determine, to do our further testing of Mr. Deadweiler. And we came back, we did our further testing, we get that. And it comes out that it is Mr. Deadweiler, essentially confirming what had happened. And it would have been great if he hadn't testified to how that the DNA profiles that Orchard had figured out had come back to Mr. Deadweiler in front of a jury of 12 people. And that's why this becomes a problem. If he hadn't said that, we wouldn't be here because it wouldn't have been an issue. But he got on the stand and testified to that. And that's why Justice Alito says, and when the state basically says, well, we've got issues here about non-testimonial, and this becomes non-testimonial. Well, the problem is juror confusion and juror misinformation and jurors not being able to evaluate that because they're not judges. And that's what happened with Williams is basically it was this bench trial, and Alito said, and they said, you know, judges can figure this out, but you got to have evaluation, juror confusion, and jury instructions, which did not happen here. So you've got the risk. I can see the jurors of 12 sitting there. As soon as Mr. Watiki said the DNA profiles from Orchard Cellmark came back pointing to Deadwell, jurors have probably started writing that stuff down because they took it substantively. And that's why we have an issue in this case, and that's why it's become a problem, because the way the state handled this case. Now, it didn't become... We don't know what Orchard would have said. We don't know how they would have handled it. We don't know. And I think the state basically, well, maybe it wouldn't have been the same person that did the testing. Well, then it becomes an issue of confrontation clause, and you get the state Williams and the state Barton. But the fact of the matter is that's not what happened in this case. And in Illinois Williams, there is never any mention about how it came up as that Williams was the one that Orchard pointed to. But that's what happened in this case. Orchard testified through Watiki that the DNA database did a hit from their sample results that matched an individual, and Watiki said, Richard Deadwell. He didn't say point to him and say it's written right there, but it's pretty clear that it's Richard Deadwell. And so even though it may or may not be non-testimonial, under Alito's decision, Justice Alito's decision, you still have to have these juror instructions and the evaluation of the risk of the juror confusion. You still have to have that there, because if without it, you've got the problem that's resulting now, and which is what Justice Alito said. He did not say it should not. He did not give any caveat. He said specifically the testimony could not, black and white, this isn't gray, absent an evaluation of the risk of juror confusion and careful jury instruction, the testimony could not have gone to the jury. And that's what happened here, is the testimony of Orchard Cellmark, and they may present, well, you know, he reviewed the things and he reviewed this, but we don't know what happened with Orchard Cellmark down there. We don't know how it was handled. We don't know what was going on. And had he just used that as reasonable reliance, say, this is what I did, you know, we get the day, we get the match, I then go out and do this. But he gets on the stand and says, Richard Deadweiler is the man that Orchard Cellmark said it matches to. Point blank. He didn't mince words about that. And the primary purpose, another thing I want to point out.
Time is up, so give me a concluding sentence or two.
Mr. Deadweiler deserves a new trial because his right to confront Orchard Cellmark had been violated. They should have been jury instructions. And the primary purpose of this testing was to catch a rapist. Period.
Counsel, before you sit down, I just want to make sure of any questions from my colleagues. I didn't want to cut them off. Okay. Thank you very much, both, Governor. Counsel. And we are in recess until this afternoon. I think shortly Justice Prosser will be addressing the group. So thank you very much.